From KQED Public Radio, this is Forum. I'm Scott Schaefer, here today for Michael Krasny. In this hour of Forum, a conversation with Pulitzer Prize-winning author Samantha Power. Her new book, Chasing the Flame, is a biography of UN diplomat Sergio Vieira de Mello. Before he died in a terrorist attack in Baghdad 4 years ago, he was a troubleshooter in some of the world's most troubled countries, including Bangladesh, Bosnia, Kosovo, and East Timor. We'll hear what he learned in those conflicts and what he was trying to do in Iraq before he was killed. All that plus your phone calls in the next hour of Forum right after this. And welcome back to Forum. I'm Scott Schaefer, and today for Michael Krasny. The name Sergio Vieira de Mello may not be familiar to you, but he's among the most distinguished and respected diplomats and humanitarians in United Nations history. In August of 2003, Vieira de Mello was heading the UN's political team in Iraq when he and 21 others were killed by a suicide bomber's attack in Baghdad. Iraq was an assignment he didn't really want, but Vieira de Mello was used to political hotspots. In 3 decades with the UN, he spent time in East Timor, Cambodia, Bosnia, Rwanda, Sudan, and Lebanon, among others. At the time of his death at age 55, Vieira de Mello was considered by some as a future Secretary General for the UN. His life is the subject of a new book called Chasing the Flame, Sergio Vieira de Mello and the Fight to Save the World. And author Samantha Power is our guest this hour. Welcome to Forum.
Great to be here.
For those of our listeners who do not know him, tell us about him. What kind of a person was he?
Well, he was previewed for me. I was a rookie reporter in Bosnia in the early 90s, and he was the number two UN official in that mission. And somebody told me that as I was about to go and meet him, that I was going to meet somebody who was a cross between James Bond on the one hand and Bobby Kennedy on the other. And there's something in that. I mean, he was Bond in that he was a great ladies' man, incredibly charismatic, very ingenious, narrowly escaped dying a number of times in his career because he was always where the bullets flew. And he was Bobby Kennedy because it was sometimes hard to tell whether he was a realist masquerading as an idealist or an idealist masquerading as a realist, to go back to Arthur Schlesinger's formulation vis-a-vis John and Bobby Kennedy. What drew me to him at this point in our country's history was the recognition that we, as we look forward onto the horizon in the 21st century, are staring down at all kinds of new threats and challenges that we don't have the tools to deal with. I would call them broken places, broken people, undergoverned spaces, failing states, these kinds of places. And those are precisely the places that Sergio spent 34 years of his UN career working in. And my feeling is we're all coming so late to these questions that if we could look to this life, which was both lived in the field in all the war zones you mentioned, but also lived with an unusual degree of self-reflection, self-criticism. That was, I think, one of the things that distinguished Sergio. He was by no means a perfect human being or a perfect diplomat, but he was remarkably self-correcting and adaptive. And so if there was some way in which, by walking in the footsteps with Sergio, we could short-circuit some of the learning that we need to do in a hurry, both as the United States and as part of the international system, it seems to me that that would be a very worthy exercise and a very urgently necessary one.
One of his philosophies, I guess you could say, as his career developed, was that you engage the enemy, that you talk to your enemies. And that's something that this country grapples with all the time. How did he come to that point of view? And was it an evolution, or did he always feel that way?
It was definitely an evolution. He started off, he's a Brazilian, son of a Brazilian diplomat, and the Brazilian military took over in 1964, actually forced his father into retirement when he was a young man, looking up at his dad. And he said at that point, I will never go into government. I will never work for Brazil. I hate Brazil. I don't trust politics. And he joined the UN, having done his undergraduate work at the Sorbonne, studied philosophy, and having stormed the barricades and thrown stones at the Parisian police and been something of a Marxist. But he joined the UN believing that the UN was somehow an antidote to state power. In other words, if you look at the UN as we understand it today, even as two things, on the one hand, the place we park our principles, principles of fundamental freedom, of self-determination, and so forth. But on the other hand, as a gathering of today 192 countries, principally a building where countries come, sadly, not to be more noble than they were before they entered the building, usually just to advance their own national interests. Sergio, when he was drawn to the UN, he was drawn to the principled part of it. He didn't kind of read the small print about it being a gathering of state power. So he thought he was turning his back on states when, in fact, he was walking into a den of states. So initially, he would take those principles and he would wave them in front of states who were deviating from international norms. He would denounce individuals and harm-doers, wrongdoers, rebels, heads of state, you name it. He was a sort of shrill advocate on behalf of humanitarian and human rights norms. At a certain point, he came to realize that he was getting nowhere, that ultimately, unless he had some of the member states of the UN at his back actually being willing to enforce or to use their leverage to press other countries to respect international norms, he was just a kind of pathetic civil servant waving a UN charter, waving his Carolina blue UN passport. And so from about his mid-30s, and I would date it actually to his mission in Lebanon after the Israeli invasion, Palestinians were using the UN base as a place from which to launch raids. The Israelis respond by basically trampling the UN en route to Beirut in 82. At that point, he said to himself, you know what? I'm never going to use the word unacceptable again. I'm going to get in the room with people who are violating international norms, whether the Palestinians in that instance or the Israelis for crossing the international border. And while in the room, I'm going to actually black box what they've done before we get into the room. So I'm going to, almost, you might even say, check my principles at the door.
So was he leaving behind his idealism?
I think he was accommodating his idealism to a very ugly and messy world. But there's no question that he went too far. That is, he went from shrill denunciation outside the room to being in the room. And I think, for instance, when I met him in Yugoslavia, he was known not as Sergio but as Serbio for his capacity to be obsequious with Slobodan Milosevic or with other harm doers. By the end of his career, and I don't want to spoil the trajectory of it because it's totally fascinating to watch a man consistently trying to advance his ideals, but believing at one stage that denunciation is the right way, another stage that obsequiousness is the right way. And then finally at the end, I think, ends up where, and we're debating this in our own domestic presidential election today, but where I think the person, Barack Obama, who I happen to be advising a little bit on foreign policy, ends up, which is you get in the room because you have to know your foe. You get in the room because you can get international wind at your back by being in the room. But when in the room, you don't forget what's been done before you got there.
And
what your principles are. And that it's actually can be tougher to be in the room and to be engaging than to be denouncing from a million miles away.
How controversial was it within the UN as he came to this realization that you have to talk to the bad guys, the really bad guys, I mean, the evildoers in the world, the real evildoers. How controversial was that within the UN, or were others there ahead of him on that?
Well, one of the amazing things when you open up a life like his, lived in these broken places, is the degree to which what to us and to the naked ear may sound like synonyms, such as human rights, humanitarianism, peace, justice, all these sort of noble ideals and these noble goods, when actually lived in practice, they're at cross purposes with each other more often than not. So in fact, within the UN system or within the NGO community, within any community of so-called do-gooders or wistful do-gooders, there's actually something of a clash between, for instance, people who believe in a pure humanitarian imperative. For instance, Sergio was in Congo in the aftermath of the Rwandan genocide, and he believed in the humanitarian imperative. He believed that the people who spilled out of Rwanda in the wake of the genocide, which included the genocidaire, the people responsible for the murder of 800,000 people, but also included maybe 1.5 to 2 million Hutu civilians, that those people needed to be fed above all. In the human rights community, people felt, hey, you got to cut off the spigot of international life support. These are genocidaire, after all. And what Sergio did is, of course, he went back to the member states and he said, I need help separating the sheep from the wolves. There are wolves in these camps. Would you, member states, United States, Belgium, and others, who turned your back on the genocide, be willing to give me some police or some enforcement power now so I can pluck from these camps the people who are these terrible evildoers? And unsurprisingly, the same governments who didn't want to do anything during the genocide certainly didn't want to do anything about the genocidaire after the fact. But I mention this because he's in the room with the genocidaire. He doesn't want to turn off the spigot of life support, but he's making decisions that it's all lesser evils terrain. You know, you're either potentially abetting the genocidaire who are planning to go back to Rwanda and continue what they started in the genocide, or conceivably you turn off the life support and that results in massive outbreaks of disease or starvation. And so depending on whether you were a human rights person who believed that you should just hold governments or non-state actors accountable to a set of principles, or you were a grocery deliverer, as he used to say, or a macaroni deliverer, an aid giver, that depended on how you, whether you judge Sergio's approach positively or negatively in a moment. I mean, he was beloved as an arch pragmatist in a system where ideals were maybe too often advanced by pure idealists who didn't know how to deal with states. So there was a sense that if you had an agenda, if you could get Sergio to do your bidding for you, charming both the dictators and the rebels on the one hand, but also international Western diplomats on the other, then you'd have a better chance of getting what you wanted.
Did he worry about being used?
Maybe not enough. I think he had a major epiphany of sorts in the wake of the Rwandan genocide and the massacre in Srebrenica in 1995 in the UN Safe Air of Srebrenica in Bosnia. And that epiphany was suddenly realizing for the first time that the UN, in fact, that UN flag that he found so consoling and so ennobling was something of a magnet for civilians, that they would see that light blue flag waving and when they were incredibly vulnerable and there was nothing else waving anyplace nearby, they would gravitate toward that flag and believe that it embodied the international community's promise to them to come to their rescue. And of course, as many remember, in both Rwanda and Srebrenica, the civilians gathered at the UN bases. And the UN peacekeepers who were there, who, yes, they're wearing blue helmets, but ultimately they answer to their capital. So in Srebrenica it was the Dutch, in Rwanda it was the Belgians. They received phone calls from their capitals and their heads of state saying, hey, just open the gates, don't worry about it, it's not our problem, we're not there to protect civilians, we're there to deter attacks against civilians. You know, this nonsense refuge taken in legal formalisms when there are civilians gathered and vulnerable around you. So when then the UN peacekeepers opened up their gates and the civilians ended up massacred, for Sergio this was just such a rude awakening, because it was really, I mean, it will sound very naive because he was 25 years into his career at that point, but finally sort of understood the untenability of neutrality, the fact that the UN missions could become not only ends in and of themselves, which was bad, but also alibis for member states who didn't want to do the real deed. They didn't really want to, for instance, arrest the genocidaire in Congo or deal with Kosovo's independence issues back in 1999 or help usher East Timor into the 21st century as an independent country. If they didn't want to do the deed, what they would often do is stick a guy like Sergio in the way and or a group of peacekeepers and say, best of luck to you. At least we can tell our domestic constituencies that we're doing something, even if we're not doing what is actually required to bring about stability or peace.
So they could basically wash their hands of it.
That was, I mean, Sergio was used both by the harm doers, the Khmer Rouge and the genocidaire and people like that, or Muqtada al-Sadr, who he met with in Iraq in 2003 before he died. I mean, the spoilers would use Sergio for their ends, but the member states were again and again using not just Sergio, but the entire sort of humanitarian aspect of the UN system, I think, to avoid dealing with the structural roots of a lot of violence that exists in the world.
We're talking this hour with Samantha Power. Her new book is called Chasing the Flame, Sergio Vera de Mello and the Fight to Save the World. She's also, by the way, the Anna Lynn Professor of the Practice of Global Leadership at the Kennedy School at Harvard University and an advisor to Barack Obama. As you mentioned, you've got your Obama 08 button on. Do you see what is it about Obama that you see? Because he has certainly this international aspect to his life. His father was Kenyan. He grew up in Hawaii. He lived in Indonesia. Do you see that part of him? Do you see any similarities with Sergio Vieira de Mello?
I do, actually, unsurprisingly, I guess, having spent 2005 and 2006 working in Obama's office and at the same time working on this book, I was struck again and again at the parallels, in part what you describe, which is this truly cosmopolitan biography, and perhaps as an outgrowth of that, a great comfort crossing borders of all kinds. I mean, in Obama's case, you know, whether racial boundaries or geographic boundaries or religious boundaries, political boundaries from the most conservative parts of our country into the most liberal. And in Sergio's case, of course, as one who spoke seven languages and worked in 14 conflict areas and had lived all over the world as a boy, that similar kind of adaptability, wherever he was, he was capable of calling home. But I think more practically, in terms of a geopolitical agenda, there are two major things that they have in common. One, as you know, Obama talks a lot about freeing our discourse from the politics of fear and talks again and again about how counterproductive decisions made in deference to fear can be, whether the invasion of Iraq or the torturing of detainees, which may seem, for some anyway, soothing for 5 minutes insofar as it creates the illusion of extracting information. But in fact, of course, has been hugely counterproductive as it's been used as terrorist recruiting fodder for people abroad. Sergio had an expression, fear is a bad advisor, which maps, I think, Obama's idea about fear, and saw again and again in these broken places the degree to which poor and underprivileged and insecure people would lunge toward the extremes in times of fear, and that they would then in turn actually make judgments or choose individuals to represent them who would make themselves make decisions that would create policies that would exacerbate their fears or give them further grounds for fear. So this kind of vicious cycle where in climates of fear we make decisions out of fear that then actually create threats that make us more afraid, and that's, I think, the spiral that we're on in this country.
And how do you change sort of the national psyche around those things? A lot of people feel that, especially now, it looks like Obama will be the nominee against John McCain, and there's a concern, I think, among some Democrats that if the country is feeling insecure come October or November for any reason, they're going to go with McCain, the military guy, the foreign affairs, quote-unquote, the foreign affairs expert, and so on. How do you, in the kind of world we're living in, where people have experienced now terror attacks on our soil, how do you get people to let go of that fear, basically, and to trust that really we need to talk to our enemies?
Well, I mean, I think it's a complicated scenario, but one of the things that both Sergio and Obama, I think, what Sergio did and what Obama does, is you reclaim the realm of national security. You don't give it over, right? You actually talk about the degree to which, for instance, policies that John McCain supported in spades, like the invasion of Iraq, have undermined American security. You invoke national intelligence estimates that show that our detention policies have caused the proliferation of terrorists and, again, been precisely the kind of fodder that al-Qaeda needed in order to enhance its recruitment efforts at a time that it was alienating people with its tactics in the Islamic world and so forth. Sergio would do the same thing. I mean, this idea that there's a dichotomy between idealism on the one hand and realism on the other is tenable in a globalized world is just wrong. And pushing back on that, I think Obama feels that national security, far from being a vulnerability for him, is in fact a sweet spot. I recognize that that's, to some, an uphill climb. But whether it comes to, you know, if you're making the argument about being in the room with Ahmadinejad, you don't make it in the context of we want to be in the room so we can be loved and kumbaya. You make it in the context of Ahmadinejad has strengthened his base in Iran by pointing to the threats of a U.S. invasion. He has almost nothing to show the Iranian people in the way of deliverables in terms of the economy or in terms of social progress. All he can point to is, you know, the enemy of my enemy is my friend. And so if Obama makes the argument for being in the room on the grounds of mobilizing international sanctions around uranium enrichment, if that's what's required, or support for terrorism, I mean, fundamentally, since there are no threats on the horizon or challenges that can be dealt with, or very few anyway, that can be dealt with by a single country acting alone, you have to make a very pragmatic case for how you summon international support for whatever policy you're putting in place. And therefore, anti-Americanism or fear of American belligerence is not just it doesn't just make us feel badly about living in a world where we're not very popular anymore. It's actually strategically hugely damaging to our ability to deal with global warming or do counterterrorism and so forth.
You were talking about Ahmadinejad and why, you know, we don't want to be in the room with him just so he'll like us. And yet you write in the book about DeMello that he liked to be liked. He disliked not being liked. Is that and there are some people who feel the same about Obama. setting aside Obama for a minute, was that a liability for DeMello? And did it somehow lead him sometimes to do things that he shouldn't have done to ingratiate himself with the people he was meeting with?
I think it's a very fair question. That same spell he was able to cast on people, a la Bobby Kennedy, there was a kind of neediness in him. And for instance, when it came to his final tragic summer in Iraq in 2003, a mission he didn't even want to take on in the first place, he was very reticent about criticizing, I should say in advance of the war in Iraq, very reticent about publicly criticizing George Bush. And then when he got to Iraq, reticent about publicly criticizing Paul Bremer. Now, whether that was because of some deep psychological need to be liked or a very pragmatic calculus about what denunciation would yield with a George Bush or a Paul Bremer. I mean, in other words, you'll never get your phone calls returned. Your ability to help the Iraqi people will become potentially nil.
You gotta have credibility
at the point that you've alienated the Americans for good. And at that time, although it's hard to remember, the Americans had, you know, they were the Cheshire Cats of Iraq. I mean, they had proved all the doomsday experts wrong. Everything was going swimmingly from their standpoint, other than minor looting and the last throes of an insurgency. So whether it was because of this desire to be liked and to maintain good relations with anyone, even people who were violating international law and norms, or because he just wanted to be in the room in the hopes that he could bring some of his technical expertise to bear with Bremer, who was a rookie at nation building. I mean, Sergio had just come from being the Bremer equivalent in both Kosovo and East Timor. He'd made a ton of the mistakes that Bremer was making, believe it or not, even with all of his rich experience and his multilingual talents and so forth. He and East Timor, like Bremer, thought that somehow he would be greeted as a liberator and not an occupier. Now, in Sergio's case, the odds were higher because the UN had helped shepherd East Timor to independence, or at least to getting rid of the Indonesians. But it turns out the Timorese wanted to govern themselves. They didn't want a UN governor or viceroy any more than they would have wanted an American one.
And then, in fact, that's one of the first things he told Bremer, that you can't be an occupying force. You've got to give the government over to the Iraqis.
And exactly. And so his logic for maintaining good ties with Bremer was, I want to be in the room to tell him about my Timor experience, to tell him not only what to do, but really what not to do, and to focus. And this was the second thing I think that Obama and Sergio have in common: dignity as a kind of cornerstone of what one thinks about. Dignity and geopolitics don't go together usually in the same sentence. But I think both Obama and Sergio, by virtue of life experiences and just a certain sensibility that they seem to have been born with, had an acute appreciation for the degree to which, even when you're doing good as a country, you can actually violate people's sense of dignity. When you promote democracy and talk down to people about, you know, there being only one single sustainable model for human progress, ours, that's not going to do wonders for people's sense of self. Similarly, the humanitarian imperative, which Sergio tried to advance in the field, could mean keeping refugee camps afloat for years on end, which was great in that the people, for instance, in Darfur today would be dead if they weren't being fed by the international community. But if you keep dignity in your mind, you'd never be satiated or satisfied with a mere refugee camp as a panacea.
Although sometimes that giving dignity to your enemies or to others who are not necessarily your friends can be seen as weak. In this country especially.
Yeah, it can be. I mean, I think this is, again, part of the rehabilitation of concepts and norms that it has to go on now as we speed ahead in the 21st century, because unless we start to talk to other countries with all of our power with respect that makes them feel sort of seen and, if not agreed with, at least heard, then we're going to have a very hard time getting the kind of cooperation we need.
Samantha Power, her new book is called Chasing the Flame, Sergio Vera de Mello and the Fight to Save the World. Much more with her in the coming 30 minutes. And if you'd like to join our conversation, the number is 866-733-6786. Again, that number, 866-733-6786. You can also email your comments to forum@kqed.org. Forum@kqed.org. Stay with us. And welcome back to Forum. Scott Schaefer here today for Michael Krasny. And our guest this hour is Samantha Power. She's a professor of professor of the practice of global leadership, rather, at the Kennedy School of Government at Harvard University. And her new book is called Chasing the Flame, Sergio Vieira de Mello and the Fight to Save the World. The number here, if you'd like to join our conversation, it's 866-733-6786, 866-733-6786. Let's go to the phones. Janet is on the line in San Mateo. Hi, Janet.
Hi, how you doing?
Good, thanks. How are you?
I'm good, thanks.
You have a question?
Well, actually, just two comments. The first comment, by the way, I'm really enjoying your speaker, very articulate, and I'm just really, really enjoying this. And I pulled off the road here in Hillsborough on my way to work because I've never been able to get through, and I had to just say this. You were talking about fear earlier, and I heard a quote. I don't know who said it, if it was a Buddhist quote or whoever said it, but it was a great quote that speaks to fear, and it is, fear is the cheapest seat in the house. I hope you can find better accommodations. And every time I hear this conversation about fear, it just speaks to that, about how easy it is to go there and how difficult it is to be disciplined and open your mind to what somebody else is doing.
It is, in some ways, Samantha, one of the big obstacles that the Democrats have, I think, to getting back the White House, isn't it?
Mm. Well, it's also, I mean, again, I think there are things to fear in the world, right? I mean, so part of the problem is, I think we should fear our melting ice caps. The problem is we're fearing a lot of the wrong things and not fearing the right things. Part of any next president's core task is going to be rebuilding trust with the American people and, again, rehabilitating words that have lost meaning, like threat, and understanding, for instance, that, actually shoring up the situation in Afghanistan is in America's interests, and going abroad and somehow being able to talk to European governments and convince them that they have a role to play as well in maintaining responsibilities. In some ways, Bush has provided such a fat target, and it's just been so easy to throw daggers at him. And obviously the combination of militarism and unilateralism and then also incompetence has made it very, very easy, not only at home, but abroad, to focus on that. And so the real challenge is going to be recalibrating our understanding of what the challenges are and embracing them, and not just sort of ducking out and saying, okay, well, Bush hyped all the threats and challenges, therefore there are no threats and challenges. Like, that can't be true either.
All right, Janet, thanks for the call. You can go back to your driving. Thanks for pulling over and being safe. Let's go now to Joe in Berkeley. Hi, Joe.
Good morning.
Morning. You're on the air.
Thank you for taking my call. I first would say thank you, Samantha, for taking the time to write the book about such a courageous and great person who Sergio was. I'm a Brazilian. I've lived in Berkeley for the last 25 years. And Sergio is not very well known in Brazil by the Brazilians in general. And I'd like to know, first of all, will the book be translated to Portuguese? Second, there is a wide understanding or a fear that the CIA was behind Sergio's demises in Iraq. He was very much against the war. He had been in communication with Saddam at that time, and he believed that Iraq didn't have the nukes or the mass destruction warfare that the administration believed in. And we feel that we lost a great Brazilian, and as a Brazilian, we have the power, because we have no enemies, to communicate and cross borders without being intimidating or without taking sides.
Let's maybe take the first question first. It's an easy one. Is it going to be translated into Portuguese?
Yeah, well, even just maybe I could say a word more about that. When I wrote this, my last book was a book called The Problem from Hell on American Response to Genocide, and for a combination of reasons, I got very fortunate with the book and the way that it was received. And
won a Pulitzer for it.
Happened to win a Pulitzer, and but also it sort of generated this, or at least contributed to generating a kind of movement of young people who carry the book around and really inspired by it and have become more politically active in trying to stop genocide. Anyway, the short answer is I was so intimidated at the idea of ever writing another word and letting these people down that I would write maybe a bad book. My second book would be a bad book. That I had some trouble initially just thinking, can I do a job that's commensurate with Sergio, with this incredible person? And what consoled me in this period of abject insecurity was the knowledge that at a minimum, no matter what I could do is I could bring Sergio back to Brazil. Just to address exactly your concern that He's sort of a silhouette of a hero in Brazil, but he's not remotely known by the people. They know the name, but they don't know the man, and they certainly don't know the kinds of struggles that he placed himself in the midst of. The short answer, again, is, in fact, it will be published in August. I'm looking forward to it more than anything associated with this book, is to go back and just be even a small part of Brazil, getting to know this person who so prided himself on his Brazilian nationality. Second question about the CIA's role.
And let's just say for listeners who are maybe just joining us that he was killed in August of 2003, along with 21 others, mostly working for the UN or all with the UN, at the Canal Hotel. A flatbed truck loaded with explosives was detonated right below where he was in the hotel.
Yeah, exactly. And it was this day in history will live in infamy, certainly, both for Iraqis and for the United Nations and for humanitarianism in general. It was in some ways the turning point of the war in Iraq. I mean, I'm one who believes that the war was determined to go badly from the start because it was a bad idea. But nonetheless, what that attack revealed is that al-Qaeda was in Iraq. Bush had predicated the war on an alleged link between al-Qaeda and Saddam Hussein. And so many people who heard stirrings of al-Qaeda in Iraq over that summer, who had not believed George Bush to begin with, believed that that was sort of like the boy who cried wolf. Those threats or the presence of al-Qaeda was not taken hugely seriously by people at the United Nations. Moreover, and I'll get to the question asked by the caller in just a second, but I think one of the greatest travesties of Bush predicating the war on a link between Saddam and al-Qaeda, the greatest travesties of not only that was fictional, but then having done that, the U.S. military undertook no preparations to actually respond to large-scale terrorist attacks on civilian targets. And as a result, when Sergio died on that terrible day, he was under the rubble for 3.5 hours.
And alive.
And alive, and talking, and asking about other members of his staff. And there was a young American EMT who went down to the bottom of a terribly dangerous shaft in order to try to rescue Sergio. That EMT, all he could rely upon literally to lift the rubble off of Sergio, because none of the equipment had been supplied to U.S. forces, because, again, these kinds of attacks, despite being linked to Saddam Hussein ahead of time, no preparation had been done to respond to them. So this young EMT, all he could rely upon was literally a curtain rope from one of the offices in the Canal Hotel to be used as a kind of pulley system. That curtain rope tied to a large women's handbag, one of those basket handbags, and then a curtain to be used as a stretcher in the event that people could be dislodged from the rubble itself. I mean, this is the most powerful military alliance in the history of mankind. So, to the caller's point, in Brazil and in Latin America generally, there's a huge amount of suspicion as to whether the country that put the man on the moon could possibly be stuck with a woman's handbag, a curtain rope, and a curtain. And, you know, they look at that, at Sergio's opposition to the war. They look at that pathetic rescue, bungled rescue. They look at the bungled occupation. And they look at the history, of course, of the CIA being involved in the assassination of Latin American leaders in some fashion. And they say, voila, therein lies, all the roots of a conspiracy. But let me say to the caller, there's no evidence at all that the United States was in any way associated with this assassination. And indeed, it's been long proven through confessions and other things, some of which may well have been extracted through a very brutal interrogation, sadly, but that this was Zarqawi, bin Laden's deputy, or the head of al-Qaeda in Iraq, the Jordanian, who was killed about a year ago. And it was a man who was just hung, in fact, on July 3rd last year for his involvement in the UN attack and a number of other attacks. I should say that when he was hung, the story barely made the international press. And to the degree that it was covered, almost nobody, in fact, nobody, mentioned al-Kurdi, this gentleman's association with the attack on the United Nations. Just as Sergio, in representing everyone, by representing the UN, you sort of represent all people of the world, all countries of the world, in his moment of need, and even in his death, he represents no one. He doesn't, other than Brazil, he doesn't really have a constituency internationally. So people didn't even follow the trial of the person who was in large measure responsible for this monstrous attack.
Joe, I thank you for the call. Our guest this hour, Samantha Power, her new book is called Chasing the Flame, Sergio Vieira de Mello and the Fight to Save the World. Given that de Mello had lived in these political hotspots, to say the least, with so much genocide and violence and danger, why didn't he want to go to Iraq? He didn't want that assignment.
He didn't want it because he hated the war. He thought the war was a very bad idea. I should say that by the end of his career, he had become comfortable favoring the use of force on rare occasions.
And bragged about it to President Bush and when he met with him before the war began.
In his, again, characteristic way of finding common ground with even people he didn't have much common ground with, he went into the meeting with George Bush and boasted about his shoot-to-kill policy that he had put in place in East Timor as a way of keeping the Indonesian-backed militia from killing civilians and burning down houses and doing the things that they had done.
To prove to Bush that he wasn't a pacifist.
That he was a manly man. He had to show he wasn't a UN,
sissy,
a girly man. So he established his bona fides. Sadly, Bush developed a kind of guy crush on Sergio, believing that this was the rare UN official who he could actually work with, that it was somebody who did understand the need to be tough with militants and so forth. And they had even though Sergio brought up Guantanamo, the International Criminal Court, Bush suddenly found himself charmed by Sergio the man, I mean, which is, again, proof that Sergio could charm just about anybody. He was known as a snake charmer, a charmer of even the most poisonous snakes in the world. But you ask the question of why he went. He did not want to go both because he had opposed the war, but also because he did not feel that the United States was ready to hear UN advice, even the most technical advice on timetables for transition, on reconstruction, on policing, on demobilization of soldiers, on transitional justice. These are very technical skills that Sergio was the rare man who had acquired, and he did not think that he would have an open door with the Americans. So he felt that the UN would simultaneously be potentially rubber stamping this occupation after the UN Security Council had been trampled by the Bush administration, and that it would be truly degrading for the UN officials in the field to have the door slammed in their face by people who didn't know what they were doing.
Back to the phones now. Another call from Berkeley. Peter, welcome to the show.
Hi, I guess we get to call you Dr. Power.
No.
Oh, it's lovely.
I don't think lawyers are doctors. Chase doctors.
Anyway, thank you so very much for your leadership, which is so evident, so important. I have a question for Leap Year. And that is, what do you think of the prospects for leaping up to true global democracy with directly elected representatives from each region? Benton Musselwhite, you may have heard of him, the attorney in Texas, is promoting the fact that Article 109, I think, of the UN Charter allows for a constitutional convention, in effect, within the rules of the UN as it exists now to totally change itself. And I find that terribly exciting and that nobody knows that.
Samantha?
Well, it's rare that I hear a question that I have never been asked or that no one has ever conceived of asking before. I mean, it's very interesting. I didn't even know about the provision in the Charter, I'm embarrassed to say. I guess what I would say is that the part of the suggestion that sounds right to me is that there's now a major disconnect between states and the statism of the international order and peoples and individuals. And indeed, while states seem again and again to find all the things they don't have in common with their neighbors, peoples might be more prone to find common consensus. Having said that, unfortunately, the role of the state in controlling armed forces and police and economies in many ways, you can't just brush it under the rug. So to have more of a voice, more of an ability to bypass state spokespeople for the national will, I think, is the right idea. But we still have to keep chipping away at making states also understand that the commons in the international system is something they have to invest resources in tending to.
You were talking about that EMT worker who rescued Sergio in the rubble in Baghdad. And during the course of those hours, at one point, they had a conversation about God, and he was asked whether or not he was religious. And he said something which we can't entirely say on the air. He said, F God. If God were just, you know, I wouldn't be in this situation. What was his spirituality, if any? Was he an atheist?
He was a longstanding atheist, former Marxist. This is Sergio. But what I find so chilling and heartbreaking about that scene, which was one of Sergio's last conversations that he had on the earth, was that in some ways this Andre Valentine's, the name of the EMT worker, and again, heroically put his life at risk, had been near the World Trade Center when Al-Qaeda hit back on September 11th, had rushed to rescue people at that point, had had his colleagues die in one of the buildings that collapsed as they tried to do rescue operations. So despite all of the personal risk to himself, he put himself in the most vulnerable position with none of the equipment that he could have rightly expected from his commander-in-chief, President Bush. And so nothing but great things to say about Andre Valentine. And yet, here he goes to the base of this shaft and almost like George Bush, can't help himself. Here is a moment, and in fairness to him, his life is at risk, and he wants to pray with Sergio, and the fact that Sergio is not a believer is not enough of a disincentive for him to have the conversation. So he continues to try to prevail upon Sergio to pray with him to the Lord Jesus Christ, our Savior, and at a certain point, Sergio just erupts. I mean, again, in one of his few last conversations on this earth, and does, I think he's less denouncing God than he is denouncing the idea that God is going to be of use to him in that final hour. But I just think, in some ways, that scene is such a metaphor for Bush, that we just, no matter what, so unempirical, often even for all some on occasion, even having good intentions in places, but being utterly tone deaf as to what the people who are the recipients of, you know, even HIV/AIDS funding and some of the good programs that Bush has put out there, even on occasions where he supports elections and democracy, again, talking down to people and ignoring what their set of beliefs are in service of projecting one's own, in this case, religious agenda, but often just seemingly, you know, in one's own from one's own perspective, patriotic agenda. It's just tone deaf.
Did he see religion as a problem in many of the countries he was in?
I think, you know, he would have believed
religious
early
strife.
On in his life that religion was the opiate of the masses and so forth. But I should say about Sergio, I mean, one of the interesting dimensions to his trajectory is the balance that he tries to strike later in life between chasing the flame of fire and conflict and being something of an adrenaline and a war junkie, but really trying to help people as well, chasing the flame of his own ideals, but a true professional emphasis, an emphasis on the world on the one hand, and then his own personal development and growth, spiritual, romantic. This question as to whether you can be in the places he's in and maintain a personal life. I think Sergio would have admitted late in life to being guilty as charged when people said that he was sometimes better or treated perfect strangers in refugee camps and in war zones and disaster zones better than he might have treated his own sons, or at least been more present for them at key moments for them than he was at his sons' birthdays and so forth. So by the end, he's both exploring his spirituality, not Christian faith, but Buddhism and other things, trying to find a way of kind of grounding himself amid all the conflict and so forth that he's seeing, but also has met a woman, is getting a divorce, is making all kinds of proclamations about he's no longer going to be a player. He's going to marry this young Argentine woman, Carolina Lariara. They're going to start a second family. He's going to do it right this second time. And I think when he got close to the summit of international statesmanship, you almost had to be there to know also the limits of the international system. I mean, I think when he was a junior person, he thought, oh, if I could only become the head of a mission, or if I could become undersecretary general, oh, okay, well, now maybe if I become secretary general, then maybe I can really make the kind of change that I seek. And in fact, as he, you know, scaled that summit, he looked around and he saw that the only way that change would come about is if member states and citizens within democracies really demanded that kind of change.
Let's see if we can get some more phone calls in. Ellen is on the line. Hi, Ellen.
Hi. Thank you so much, Ms. Powers, for your body of work and this book about Sergio's contributions to humanitarian issues. I'm wondering, as candidates debate about a continued U.S. military presence in Iraq, what seems to be lacking in that debate is the U.S.'s role in response to the Iraqi refugee crisis as a result of this war. Catholic Charities just returned from the Middle East, where we looked at the Iraqi refugee situation, and what we hear is there are an estimated 2.5 million refugees that are both in Syria and Jordan. Those numbers are debated, but nevertheless, the numbers are significant, and this is not a crisis that's going to evaporate. And clearly one that our new president, hopefully Obama, will need to address. Mm-hmm. So could you speak to that?
Absolutely. Surely. I've actually written about it myself and share your outrage not only at the neglect of the refugee and displaced population in the region, in Iraq, the displaced population in Iraq, the refugee population in the region, but also some horror at the paltry number of asylum slots the United States has opened up for Iraqis who worked with the U.S. mission. I mean, it's embarrassing. Sweden has taken something like 8 times more refugees than the United States has. Let me say this about Obama, which will surprise you, and it disappoints me that this will surprise you. But in May or June, in fact, of last year, Obama gathered a group of us, of his advisors, together and said, I'm really sick of this debate and this kind of false dichotomy about the question of withdrawal. On the one hand, you have people like John McCain saying, if we leave, there'll be a massacre that'll make Rwanda look like a picnic, suggesting, implying that somehow staying is staving off those massacres, which it isn't. And then on the progressive side of the spectrum, there's a sort of, I don't want to call it a narcissism, but some belief that somehow the United States now is causally responsible for everything that goes wrong in Iraq and all the harm that is done to civilians. And while that may have been true at the beginning, certainly these harms have followed the U.S. presence. When the United States leaves, there are plenty of harms that will go on in our wake and some that may even in the short term be caused by our withdrawal. And so what Obama said is we need not just a withdrawal plan, we need a responsible withdrawal plan. And so the reason I'm frustrated to have to tell you this is it's frustrating that it hasn't kind of permeated in the debates and sadly no one's really asked about what will be the welfare of Iraqis when we leave. Is anybody putting them center stage in their minds?
But isn't that what McCain is saying in terms of why we can't leave?
No, but he's saying you can't leave, but he doesn't have a story to tell about what he's actually going to do to enhance civilian protection or how the political strategy is going to abet the military surge strategy. So what Obama did was he came out and he said, okay, $2 billion refugee assistance plan off the bat to Iraq's neighbors who are shouldering the refugee burden you mentioned, fair notice to Iraqis, potential use of U.S. transport vehicles to move Iraqis, sadly, who might want to move from mixed neighborhoods to homogenous neighborhoods, a war crimes commission. I mean, there are all kinds of war crimes and crimes against humanity being committed, and nobody's even pulling together a list of the most wanted so that you could at least maybe curb their travel
patterns. Let me ask you a question.
Patterns in the neighborhood. Yes.
You know, many of these things I imagine Hillary Clinton is also talking about.
She hasn't addressed this issue, in fact.
But Obama's point seems to be that even though he doesn't have much foreign policy experience, that somehow it doesn't matter. And when you look at McCain and Clinton, they've had different experiences, of course. But, I mean, the world is a dangerous place. Why would we want to have a commander-in-chief who really has had so little time actually working on these issues, being in the Oval Office or being, you know, in rooms where these tough decisions are being made?
Well, I mean, obviously, his rival now in the Democratic nomination has not been in those rooms either. She didn't sit in on any National Security Council meetings or anything like that while she was the First Lady. But she's certainly been proxy, you know, privy to the aftermath of those meetings. There's no question there, and has seen the strain that being commander-in-chief can place on somebody very, very close to her and on her as well, of course. So, I understand the concern that people have. I think Obama's point is simply, look, if all that Washington experience buys you support for this boneheaded war that has led us down this disastrous path, then one must ask very difficult questions about what being in Washington does to free-thinking individuals. I mean, if it makes you beholden to old ways of doing things or to reflexive, understandings of the land of the possible, the bandwidth for foreign policy debate in Washington is so circumscribed. And if it makes you beholden to focus groups or to special interests, then that is going to distort your ability to advance the national interest. Moreover, he's traveled in the world and on. And again, he feels his sweet spot, ironically, is foreign policy, is national security. Does that prepare him for the most difficult job that anyone can imagine, to inherit the Afghan war and the Iraq war on day one? As he would say, not even John McCain is prepared to be commander-in-chief at this difficult time. But has he, over a lifetime of 25 years in public service, demonstrated the kind of judgment, cool-eyed thinking, non-ideological, pragmatic thinking that can actually help us through these difficult times? I think absolutely.
All right, let's go back to the phones. David is on the line in San Francisco. David, welcome to the show.
Hello. I just had a question on about Sergio and another caller about fear. I've worked in all over East Africa, and my last spot was Rwanda when the genocide was going on. And the people in the camps, as far as living a life of fear, they had to take that decision because their leaders really played on fear, and they kept them in the camps because of fears. And so they were at the lowest level of Maslow's triangle because they were just trying to survive. And I'd like to have your comment on the contrast of that to the United States and the people who are sitting watching this in a very comfortable position, really have no fear to do and make decisions to elect the leaders that they can elect now. The contrast is so diverse and so widespread, and I just would like your comment on that.
Samantha.
It is a contrast, and yet if you look at 2004 and the election at a time where, as you say, perhaps we didn't have comparable reasons to fear, and certainly not reasons to fear like people living in Iraq today or as you say, living in Congo or in Rwanda back in the mid-90s. And yet a lot of people voted out of fear, reelected George Bush out of fear that if you were to disrupt, even if you hated the war in Iraq and thought it was going disastrously, a lot of independents and even some Democrats voted for Bush on the logic that you couldn't afford to disrupt the chain of command at a time when U.S. soldiers and were in harm's way. So, I mean, there are plenty of U.S. Military families who are living in genuine fear right now that they're going to get that awful phone call in the middle of the night. And I think, again, figuring out how to only put people in that position of genuine fear at moments of extremity and when our national security is really at stake is something the next president is going to have to do.
Very quickly, if you would, just a few seconds left, the lesson of Sergio Vieira de Mello's life. What do we take from it, his life and death?
Well, I've mentioned already, I think, the core lesson, which is thinking far more about dignity, even above and beyond democracy or human rights. I think they can stem from an attention to dignity. I also think I'm hoping young people read this book and understand that there's a role for all of us somehow in thinking about public service, that this life kind of inspires those of us who've been yearning since 9/11 to be told by the president how we can make a difference in the world. I'm hoping that the Obama movement reflects a desire by citizens to really play a part in the solutions and not merely, of course, complaining about the state of things as it stands today.
Samantha Power. Her new book is called Chasing the Flame, Sergio Vieira de Mello and the Fight to Save the World. By the way, she'll be at Stacy's Books today at 12:30 for a book signing if you want to talk to her there in person. And then tonight she'll be in Berkeley at the First Congregational Church at 7:30. That one's sponsored by Cody's Books. Thanks very much for being here. Fascinating topic and lots more to talk about in the months ahead with regard to all these issues. Samantha Power, thanks so much for being here. Forum is produced by Tina Lauerberg and Kevin Guillory. We had some production assistance from Nick Vidinsky. Also, our senior producer, Dan Zoll. Our engineer today is Dave Freeman. And our executive producer is Raul Ramirez. I'm Scott Schaefer, here today for Michael Krasny, who returns tomorrow. Thanks for listening.
Funds for the production of Forum are provided by the members of KQED Public Radio and the Claude and Louise Rosenberg Jr. Family Foundation.